people's conversations turned musical, street signs. It was like a musical tornado. And it was fairly terrifying and utterly absorbing.
Actress Mary Steenburgen went in for routine surgery on her arm, and when she woke up, her brain was changed forever. Stranger still, an accordion comes into the story. And after Victoria Mahoney became the first woman and person of color behind a camera on a Star Wars movie, will things change in Hollywood?
Something that happens in the industry that's prevalent through all the studios is whenever someone says they're going to hire a person of color, they hire a male. And when they say they're going to hire a woman, they hire white.
Plus, Michael Stipe walked away from music when REM disbanded in 2011. Now he's back. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Coming up later in the show, we imagine an alternative Oscar ballot, but we'll start today with Michael Stipe. For more than three decades, he was the lead singer of REM. They made 15 albums together, and then they split up in 2011. After that, Stipe showed up occasionally like an elf on a shelf on Stephen Colbert's old Comedy Central show.
For years, I have acquired so many meaningful keepsakes, leftover Vaxa products, pints of Americone Dream, and my one-of-a-kind Michael Stipe, who has been sitting on my shelf over there for 3 years.
Would someone dust me?
Hey, that's you in the corner. It's me in the spotlight. Read your contract.
But recently, Stipe got back into a music studio, and he celebrated a big birthday. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you. I'm 60 years old now.
I see it on the horizon for myself. I'm a 1960 kid myself.
There you go. All right. Well, it's not so scary. I have to say it's a little less frightening than 50.
That's good to hear. Stipe recently released two singles, his first solo work since REM, and each song comes with a beautiful music video.
Music, as big of an impact and as much as big of a part as it has played in my past, in my history, music creates a wall between me and the rest of the world because I think I'm a bit of a control freak. And when I work on something, I want it to be really not just good. It's got to either be great or it doesn't go out into the public. And I was that way with REM for 32 years. That's heavy carrying. So when REM disbanded, I just needed to take a break. I needed to not think about music for a while. And it kind of crept back in. And then I found myself working with this group of people that, in particular, Andy LeMaster, singer, songwriter, engineer, and producer, and who's a great friend. We started writing on synthesizer, and I'm not a musician. I played a classical piano as a child, and I played accordion as a third grader, but I don't know how to play any instrument. And yet, how to compose and how to put music together in a way that's arresting and inspired is something that I've been surrounded by my whole adult life. And so anyway, it was a grand experiment. Can I compose? Can I write my own music? And it turns out I'm not bad at it.
I'm going to play the song that you did with Andy LeMaster. This is called Your Capricious Soul.
Honey's got a new feeling. Honey peeled herself off the ceiling. Because God is revealed.
I should also point out there's a beautiful video for this song directed by Sam Taylor Johnson, who is a great photographer and made the John Lennon film Nowhere Boy. It's a single take of a young girl. I'm wondering where this song started because I cannot separate the song from this visual image that Sam Taylor Johnson created. But what was the image or the idea in your mind when you started working on it?
Ah, that makes me so happy, and so happy for Sam. She's a great friend, and I was thrilled with the piece that she presented me. I kind of approached her with this idea and told her what I was picturing, and she took it and, of course, turned it into something completely hers. What inspired it for me? A photograph, actually. A picture that I saw of someone who I love very much, who's now no longer with us, and the word caprice was written. It was a large part of the image. The person I'm talking about is Jeremy Ayres. And I started thinking about caprice and the idea of capriciousness, and it turned into this lyric. It completely surprised me. I didn't expect it. I don't actually really remember writing the lyric, which is always a good thing. I snuck up on myself and was like, wow, these are good. Who wrote them? And it was me.
We're talking with Michael Stipe, formerly of REM, about his new solo work. You describe this kind of pressure to do things as perfectly or as well as possible with the band, which is both kind of an obligation and also a burden, I would think. How do you free yourself from that? Or are you still stuck thinking that way, that it is, if it isn't perfect, I can't do it?
It was an obligation, and it was because I was representing more than myself. I had to represent the entirety of REM, and I maintain that we, as a group, were greater than the sum of our parts. That said, as a solo artist, I now have two singles out that you mentioned. Thank you very much. I'm kind of excited by what I'm doing, and not kind of. I'm really excited by it, and it's thrilling and exciting to take all that stuff that I learned with the band and apply it to this kind of new adventure for myself.
I want to play another one of your songs. It's called Drive to the Ocean. Another music video goes along with it, directed by yourself.
We stand at the water, the wind and the sun. Where all of God's creatures are gathered as one. Surfacing, crowning, we blast right through. Histories and riches and residue. We came to explore. Just look where that got us. Look where that got us.
I kind of read this as a like climate change ballad. when you were thinking about this song,
good call.
Is that something that might have been in the front of your mind?
Actually, yes. For me personally, that's exactly what it's about. Now, I love the idea that a song can go out into the world and people can apply all kinds of interpretation, whatever it is that they need or want from music and from a lyric. As long as it's not nefarious or hateful, they can apply that to anything that I write. But yes, I was thinking about the end of something and the beginning of something else. And in the world that we're living in right now, that certainly applies to climate change.
How would you describe the role of artists about starting conversations, getting people to think in a new way? How would you describe the opportunity and the responsibility for an artist?
Yeah, profoundly, profoundly important, and important culturally, I think, very, very, very important. I think of artists as a way of, I think my job as an artist is really to help present who we are and what we are right now and what we might be moving towards that is a better version of ourselves. And I see that as a job. It's a really fun job, and it's a great job to have. It does carry some responsibility. I wish that the media that we have currently in America felt the same responsibility as a fourth estate and such an important part of political discourse. They've certainly failed us in the past couple of decades.
Michael Stipe is a photographer, a film producer, a musician, and he has two new songs. Michael, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. This week began with nominations for the Academy Awards, where once again, there were no women directors nominated. And once again, almost every acting nominee is white. For longtime Academy watchers like me, it was frustrating. Franklin Leonard shared my disappointment, so he created his alternative Oscar ballot and published it in an essay in the Washington Post. Leonard is the founder of The Blacklist. It's an annual catalog of the most liked but unproduced scripts in Hollywood, many of which actually go on to win Oscars.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
So, were it not so sad, your column is almost funny. It could have been a satirical piece from The Onion. What motivated it?
Well, I mean, here's the interesting thing, right? Like, it didn't necessarily need to even be read as satire. If anything, you know, the article was written as a list of all of the people who could reasonably have been nominated in place of those who got nominated. And I think that there are additional people that aren't even mentioned in the article who also could have gotten reasonably nominated, and no one would have batted an eye, except for the fact that it would have been unusual that all of the nominees were people of color, that all of the directing nominees were women, which, you know, is so far from our reality only because history would suggest that all of the nominees should be white and all of the directors should be men.
Well, let's talk about that, because there was a lot of great artistic accomplishment from people who weren't nominated. I think about Hustlers from Laureen Scafaria and the star Jennifer Lopez, Lulu Wang, the director of The Farewell, Greta Gerwig, who made Little Women, performances by Alfre Woodard in Clemency, Awkwafina in The Farewell, the entire cast of Parasite nominated for Best Picture. None of the actors were. So what's the disconnect in your mind between the great work and the recognition or lack of recognition of that great work?
I mean, the short answer is racism and sexism and the intersection between the two. I think that there's a fundamental lack of appreciation for the work of women directors and the work of actors of color. I mean, I saw it on my Twitter timeline a bit yesterday, people saying, oh, well, Jennifer Lopez wasn't really acting. She was just playing herself, you know, and I think there's an assumption that, you know, the actors in Parasite are somehow, that's just who they are. They're not actually performing. If you've been in a room with Song Kang-ho, you know that that was a heck of a performance. So I think that the assumptions and the appreciation and the value that we give to these performances and to these directing sort of accomplishments is diminished because of who's doing it. Someone told me, you know, why are you trying to inject politics into these decisions? And it's not that I'm trying to inject politics into it. It's that politics are already in it. I'd like to see them removed, or at least an acknowledgement of the extent to which the politics are already there.
We're talking with Blacklist creator Franklin Leonard about this year's Oscar nominations. I read a piece in The Guardian about how award nominations granted to people of color, especially women, are often for subservient roles like slaves, nannies, and maids. And that's movies like 12 Years a Slave, The Help, Babel, even Roma. Do you think there's some truth in that? For the few women and women of color who are recognized, they play a certain kind of part and not another kind of role.
Yeah, I think it's pretty inarguable if you look at the list of women of color that have been nominated and won. You know, I suppose Cynthia Erivo's nomination is progress because she's not playing a slave the entire time and actually is playing a freedom fighter who rescues slaves. But no, I think that there's, again, there are assumptions by a large percentage of certain demographics of American culture and really sort of Western culture about what role is appropriate for women and specifically women of color. They are far more comfortable with women in those roles than they are if you stray too far afield. And I suspect Jennifer Lopez playing a stripper who gets one over on the men that she's supposed to be dancing for left a significant percentage of members of the Academy uncomfortable.
Since actors are by far the biggest block of Academy voters, why do the Oscar nominations differ from the Screen Actors Guild, which nominated Jamie Foxx from Just Mercy, Lupita Nyong'o from Us, and Jennifer Lopez from Hustlers?
I suspect it's age. I'm not an expert on this, so you can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but the threshold to join SAG is a lot lower in terms of career accomplishment than the threshold to join the Academy. And therefore, it sort of seems inevitable that the Academy voters are probably, at least the mean, significantly older than your average SAG voter. And given the changes that have happened in the industry, particularly over the last 20 years, I suspect that has something to do with the differing nominations.
The Academy, to a certain extent, can only recognize movies that get made, even if Oscar voters still ignored a lot of great work from underrepresented filmmakers and actors. Now, you've worked as a creative executive in Hollywood. So from where you sat on that side of the table, what needs to change in the kinds of movies that are made and who gets to make them so the Academy voters at least can pick from a wider pool of eligible performances and films?
No, I think the same changes that need to be made in any hiring environment where there's endemic bias. You know, we need to hire a labor force that's more representative of the culture as a whole. We need to empower them to tell the stories that they're most excited about telling. We need to make sure they have the resources to tell those stories well. And then I think that combined with the changing demographics of the Academy membership, I think you'd see a real shift over time in what gets awarded. But I think it's really important to remember that, you know, the reason this conversation sort of pivots around the Academy is that that is the time during the year when the industry is most visible to the world. And I think that it's the time when, you know, sort of there the most outside pressure can be exerted. And it's the clearest opportunity to make these cases, right? That no women were nominated for Best Director, it's a lot easier to understand that than it is to understand that 90% of the movies that are directed at studios are directed by men, right? So I think that that's why this conversation happens around this time of year. But the real issue, and the one that matters, is who tells the stories of our time? Do they have the resources to tell them? And do they have the autonomy to tell them as they see fit?
So let me ask you this last question. We know that the Academy, I suspect, is probably a little mortified that only one person of color was nominated in the acting races and that no women were nominated for directors. Is it going to be same as it always was a year from now, 2 years from now? How quickly are we not going to be having this conversation?
You know, I think that at the end of the day, we're dealing with small data sets. And, you know, it takes a long time to make movies, put movies into the marketplace, and then run them through the award season. So, you know, even if everything changed as of today, we probably wouldn't be looking at a major change until 2022. And as we all know, those changes tend to be a bit even more glacial in the industry. So it's hard to say, you know, hopefully within this decade, Lord knows I'm going to do everything I can to make sure it happens faster, both because I think it would be good for the culture. And I suspect an industry that looked a little bit more like its audience would also make a lot more money.
Franklin Leonard is the creator of The Blacklist. His piece in The Washington Post is called "The 2020 Oscar Nominations Didn't Have to Look Like This." Franklin, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll meet a unicorn in the Star Wars universe, the first woman to have directing duties, and she's African-American.
So the first unit director, J.J. Abrams, in my case, on our film, he goes about his day, plots it, plans it, moves it, grooves it, and then most of my day-to-day work includes action, stunts, explosions, all the shit I love.
Victoria Bahoney is up next on The Frame Weekend. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. As we're taping this, Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker has grossed more than $1 billion worldwide, and one of the key people on the film's crew quietly made franchise history. Victoria Mahoney is the first woman and the first person of color to work as a director on any Star Wars film. She was the second unit director on Rise of Skywalker, where she worked alongside the film's director and co-writer, J.J. Abrams. So for people who don't understand the difference between first and second unit, how would you describe to the novice movie fan what that means?
So the first unit director, J.J. Abrams, in my case, on our film, it's his vision. It's in a true sense, because he's also the co-writer. So he goes about his day, plots it, plans it, moves it, grooves it, and then he shoots out a sequence, a scene, a location, and then a second unit director comes in behind the first unit director and will shoot in that exact location. Most of my day-to-day work includes action, stunts, explosions, all the shit I love. And then these other dramatic beats, believe it or not, that are just here. They're just pieces that we sometimes pick up. If JJ's on the move and he needs to get to the next location, there's one or two components in a place and we're coming in behind. So he shoots, and usually the day after, the week after, when he's done with that location, we go into that soundstage or that location in the woods or wherever we are, and we pick up the pieces. And we do get to do the what I consider the fun stuff.
Now, second unit directors, when they go off and do their work, and I'm using they, but when he goes off and does his work, because this is a job even within the incredibly uneven playing field that is Hollywood, men are probably 99% of the second unit directors. Maybe it's even higher than that. There are certain categories of jobs where you just don't see women working.
Mm-mm. Not even considered, mildly.
Not even considered.
And it's, go finish your sentence. Were you going to say something else?
I think you know where I'm going. So how does that happen and how does it change?
So there are two components to that question. One, the first one is it happens because there's an extreme comfort and I will say probably laziness to the proactivity and how people pursue hires. So it's people just reach over to their left or right side and whoever lives next door to them or plays with their kids at their school or goes to their, you know, coffee shop or restaurant or someone's friend or cousin or uncle or whatever. But it's like a list comes and they just take off. You know, it's like that guy, this guy, the other guy. That's it. Then the answer to the second part of your question is better suited to the studio chiefs and the producers and the executives who I'm not sure if they're getting that question and I'm not sure if they have an answer, because most of the time when we present information to them, it's as if it's the first time they ever heard it. I kid you not. You could look at someone's face and realize, oh my God, we never hired. There are no women in second unit directing. It's brand new information to them.
We're talking with Victoria Mahoney. She's the second unit director on Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. And you have said that to step out of those hiring practices, in this case, wasn't the studio. It was J.J. Abrams who said, let's think differently.
Right. And one of the things that's amazing when I talked to J.J. about his insight in making this decision, he was really clear that the position he has in town allows him certain choices. And who would he be if he didn't make such a choice? And Katie McGrath, who runs Bad Robot, has a very, very clear sense of that.
This is
his wife and everything that they do within the company. But, you know, she's a badass, came through Washington, was a force in her own way. And the movement that she does quietly throughout the industry is very impactful. And the scariest thing to me is since then, there's no news on any other top tier franchise film that hired someone similar to me. Not at all.
Well, there is news, and it was by Stacey Smith at the USC Annenberg Inclusion Initiative. And
oh,
she did a
that.
Study. And what it found is that Hollywood still doesn't hire a lot of women or underrepresented directors, people of color. And the worst company is the Walt Disney Company. In this period that was studied, 1,300 films, Disney hired 164 directors, 10 were underrepresented directors, women or people of color.
Something that I talked about often and I just feel like people need to get traction on is something that happens in the industry that's prevalent through all the studios is whenever someone says they're going to hire a person of color, they hire a male. And when they say they're going to hire a woman, they hire white. And this is worth discussing.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's just last question. So if there's a young black girl who goes to see Star Wars and you're sitting next to her and you're leaning over during the movie, what are you going to say? What scene? I shot that. I did that. What would you point out?
Well, I probably wouldn't say that in a way that it's the same as any DP would never say. That's my frame, you know, just in the ethics of it because I'm so old school. But what I would say probably is you can do that. That's what I would say. And if it went further into really can, I was like, yes, you can.
Victoria, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, John, for having me.
Victoria Mahoney was the second unit director on Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. There's a new musical on TV. It's called Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. And in the series, the lead character hears people singing when no one else does. For one actor in the show, this seemingly fantastical concept isn't that crazy. Frame contributor Tim Grieving has the unusual story of how Mary Steenburgen went from actress to singer and songwriter.
You see, I mean, I just literally, this is what I do all day. I play weird French little cafe riffs.
Mary Steenburgen is playing the accordion for me at her home in the Pacific Palisades.
I'm just making something up badly.
If you know her from dramatic roles like Melvin and Howard or as Doc Brown's love interest in Back to the Future Part 3, the image of Mary Steenburgen playing the accordion and writing songs may surprise you. How this all came about certainly surprised her.
In April 2007, I had a surgery on my arm, and it wasn't a huge deal, but it did require that I went under general anesthetic. When I came out from under the surgery, my arm felt fine, but my brain felt strange. And the best way I can describe it is that the sound of my mind for my whole life was different, and it was replaced with this sort of overscored movie. It felt like people's conversations turned musical, people's questions to me. The answer was somehow musical, street signs. It was like a musical tornado. And it was fairly terrifying and definitely utterly absorbing. I remember just looking in the mirror and saying, you know, it's not going away. So you've got to figure this out because you've got four kids. They count on you. You have a husband, you have a career, and you can't go nuts. You know, you have to make sense of it. I didn't know what to do other than just start studying how people wrote songs.
That husband she mentioned is Ted Danson, you know, from Cheers and The Good Place.
We flew to Europe with friends to go on this 2-week kind of holiday. We were in Italy driving in a van to go to the hotel. And I knew she had written a song that night while I slept on the plane. But she said, hey, I wrote a song. Do you mind if I sing it to you? And, you know, everyone kind of either literally or metaphorically kind of rolled their eyes and went, yes, of course, of course. And out came this really remarkable song. By the end of the summer, she'd written, I don't know, 40, 50 songs. And it truly was like I was married to somebody else.
I broke up with a man in the moon last night. Had enough of his whimsical smile.
She sang the music that was swirling in her head into a tape recorder, then professional musicians translated those ideas into songs. Pretty soon she'd signed a publishing deal with Universal, went to Nashville, and started churning out dozens of songs with co-writers.
I actually think it was more physical than magical. I feel like I connected to a part of my mind that I just didn't have access to before.
Which brings us to Wild Rose, the movie starring Jesse Buckley as a troublemaking young mom from Glasgow, Scotland, who desperately wants to go to Nashville to become a country music star.
I'm training to be a country singer.
Nobody wants to see a convicted criminal out there.
Johnny Cash is a convicted criminal, you ball bag.
The movie needed a song for the big finale after Buckley's character, Rose Lynn, gets to Nashville and realizes there's no place like home. Steenburgen saw the call for song submissions through Universal. Inspired, she wrote the song Glasgow with two Nashville singer-songwriters, Caitlin Smith and Kate York. She pulled her iPad out and played me the original demo. This is Caitlin Smith singing.
I've worn out the stones in front of your doorstep. Come in, go away. Come in, go away. Come in and go in.
She's so freaking talented that I was scared that I said, I hope your voice is not too good to be sending in because it's intimidating. No one sounds like this. But then we saw this rehearsal of Jesse and we were all blown away, just blown away.
Had to you know that I
write something in a room in Nashville, Tennessee, and it goes over to Scotland, and this Irish girl is singing it, and somehow you're all totally connected to it. You all own it.
Ted Danson is kind of in awe of his wife.
The biggest lesson, I think, was her willingness to say yes. It would have been much more reasonable to say, well, I'm not going to start writing music at 50, whatever she was. That's silly. I'm not going to have a publishing deal with a major label. That's ridiculous. I can't go step into these Nashville artists who have been doing this all their lives and expect to be accepted. Everything was unreasonable, and yet she said yes to life.
Among the things Mary Steenburgen said yes to recently, she's writing the songs for an animated film called The Underneath. She'd also like to learn how to play the guitar.
It's much more useful to play the guitar, but I'm not good at stringed instruments, at least not so far. That's going to require another surgery.
That was a joke, she let me know. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
If you're just joining us, this is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Turning Hollywood movies into Broadway shows, especially musicals, has become really commonplace. Think of The Lion King, Billy Elliot, Matilda, Tootsie. The list is very long and growing. So the idea of adapting Moulin Rouge seemed like a natural choice. But it required reworking the movie's songs into a different structure and getting rights to dozens of new songs that weren't in Baz Luhrmann's 2001 film. That was the job of the show's music supervisor and arranger, Justin Levine.
The lyrics were of the utmost importance. And so while we certainly were looking for songs that were popular or that would be recognizable to the majority of our audience, it was really important that the lyrics served story and character.
I'm going to play a snippet of an iconic song. First, we're going to hear the film version. Then we're going to hear your Broadway version of the same song.
There's no way, because you can't pay.
In the name of love, one night in the name of love.
You crazy fool, I won't.
Don't leave me this way.
Okay, that's the movie version. Now the Broadway version.
There's no way, 'cause you can't pay.
In the name of love, one night in the name of love.
You crazy fool, I won't give in to you.
It's so easy. All you have to do is fall in love.
Love hurts.
All you have to do is play the game.
Love scars.
All you have to do is take on.
No, no,
so, fair to say, Aha was not in the movie version. So
that is correct.
How did you approach that song? Because it is both very similar and radically different.
The way I began building that number was I made a list of all of the love songs and anti-love songs I could think of, and I printed up all the lyrics
That's
for them.
That's going to be a long list.
Yes.
That's basically every piece of pop music.
It's a lot. It was a lot. And actually what I ended up doing was I looked at how in the film Christian sings a line from a song and then Satine sings it back. But with different lyrics to refute his point.
It's basically a game. It's like a word game.
Exactly. And I had the idea, what if actually Satine brought in some of her own music into this battle?
Take on me.
No, 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 it ain't me.
Take me on.
No, no, no.
So what I did was, as I looked through these lyrics, and I'm talking about hundreds of pages, I was circling things, highlighting things, and then I started cutting them up, literally cutting them up and putting them on the floor of my office. And so I built this conversation that finishes the beat of the scene much in the way that you would if you were writing an original song for a musical.
We're talking with Justin Levine about Moulin Rouge, the musical. I want to play one song that you didn't get. I hope it's not too painful, but let's listen to this song. I'm too hot. Call the police and the fireman. I'm too hot. That's Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars. And people need to understand that when it comes to licensing songs, for a song like that, you're licensing the composition. And the composition of Uptown Funk is by 11 people. I think 10 people said yes, except one, and his name is Bruno Mars.
That's right. That is right. you know, I completely forget that, you know, that we had it in the show for so long before we lost that song. And, you know, it's interesting because it's one of the challenges of doing a show this way is that we had to simultaneously go through the rights process while also building the score, which meant that I had to go into it knowing that this was bound to happen. But, you know, the thing about Moulin Rouge, and I would say this about the film as well, is that it's bigger than just one song, right? No one song can hold up the show. Although, you know, obviously what you want to find is a song that feels essential in that moment. And so that doesn't mean that we were going to settle for just sliding something in. You know, it meant that I would have to go back into my hole and really dig far deeper to figure it out.
Well, as we go out, let's listen to your arrangement of your song from Moulin Rouge, the musical. Justin Levine is the show's music supervisor, arranger, orchestrator, and lyricist. Justin, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
So excuse me for getting, but these things I do. You see, I've forgotten if they're
Moulin Rouge, the musical, has a Grammy nomination for Best Musical Theater Album. Coming up on the Frame Weekend, the directors of the documentary American Factory. It's the first film from Barack and Michelle Obama's Netflix deal, and it just got an Oscar nomination. We'll be right back.
You can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down in words.
Welcome back to the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Last year, around this same time, we were at the Sundance Film Festival, and among the amazing documentaries that screened there was American Factory.
We stand here today with a plant that's closing, but I'm extremely proud of the people that work in this plant here.
This week, American Factory was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. The film tells the story of what happens when a Chinese auto glass company named Fuyao opens a factory in a former auto assembly plant in Ohio.
It's going to help grow this community, give people jobs, and give a future to your kids and my kids.
The film was directed by Stephen Bogner and Julia Reichardt. In 2009, they made the short film The Last Truck, Closing of a GM Plant. And in some ways, it's kind of a prequel to American Factory.
The film The Last Truck had been on HBO and had the great fortune of being an Oscar nominee. And we were very, very proud of that film, but we thought that chapter of our filmmaking was over. And then in 2014, that dead factory was bought by a Chinese billionaire entrepreneur who owns the largest manufacturer of windshields, of auto glass in the world. And he bought this dead factory and said, I'm going to reopen it, and we're going to start making windshields in America.
We established relationships with a lot of people who worked in that plant, and they trusted us. Workers in Dayton, Ohio, really embraced that film. So when we went in there to talk to the workers on the line, and we were like, yeah, we made The Last Truck, it was like instant trust.
Well, you have the trust of some of these former GM workers, but much more important to the making of this film is the trust of Fuyao.
because they give you access that is beyond comprehension. And you are in some incredibly candid moments. You get to hear people saying things that they probably shouldn't say and shouldn't say on camera. So how did you go about approaching Fu Yao, and what was your pitch to them, and why did they invite you in?
When we were talking to the company, we said we would do it if it was independent, we owned it, and we had editorial control, and we can't take any money from the company to do this. And they agreed. And it was largely the chairman. The chairman is, you know, he's over 70. He's a maverick. And he said, let's do it. Let's make it real. And along the way, during the 3 years of filming, there was more than one occasion when he said to his people around him, this is a documentary. It's not a promotional film for Fu Yao. It's a real documentary. So go with it. He kind of told his team, we're going to let this happen. And that was huge for us.
Especially in a country like China, where people are kind of used to, you know, the leader, you follow whatever they say, you fall in line. So people did. I mean, his presidents, his vice presidents, his management, they might not have always liked us being there, but they were told by the chairman we had to be let in.
We're talking with Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichert. They're the co-directors of the documentary American Factory. There are so many different stories that are happening in this film. One is how American workers are adapting to their new managers and their new manager's view of how a factory should be operated. And then there's another part of the story, which are the Chinese workers who are living in the United States. They are cut off from their families for years at a time. They're living in what we would not call, you know, very nice housing. They're making very little money. How important was it to this film to make sure that they were represented and what they were going through? Because as an American worker might see it, what they were going through was not at all pleasant.
When we started the film, our sort of sensibility, our point of view was rooted and grounded in our Midwestern blue-collar folks that we know and love. And as we were in that factory, we started realizing there's a whole other community, and we are far on the outside of that community, but they're essential to this story. They're totally crucial to the story. We had to ask ourselves, like, how do we try to access those folks who don't speak English? And that's when we brought on our two Chinese co-producers, Yichen Zhang and Mija Li, who started coming to Ohio, going into the factory with us every day. It was hard for us as Midwesterners and white folks and, you know, non-Asian folks to try to get into those communities. But with these two awesome producers, we eventually did.
In the midst of filming, something happens that you probably might have guessed could happen, but certainly couldn't have 100% predicted, and that is that there's a move to unionize the factory.
We didn't expect there to be a union vote. We didn't know it was going to happen. Something we really started learning about, though, and wanting to document, was the union avoidance company that was brought in at very big expense by the company, and that is called Labor Relations Institute. There are lots of these kind of companies all across the country. They were paid well over $1 million to fight the union.
And to actively discourage workers to vote against unionization.
Yeah. The company itself, we later learned when we started getting translations of some of the Chinese, also like kind of taught their supervisors to be anti-union and how to get rid of workers who were pro-union.
Which is actually against the law.
Which, of course, is against the law, and it should be against the law. Because how do workers get a voice if they can't organize and without fear of being fired? And so many people were fired.
I got the phone call from Fu Yao that they had fired me. I really, truly feel like that they targeted me. I was on the news. I was at the city council meetings.
At the same time, we wanted to include anti-union voices in the film.
Including workers who say
very articulately why they're opposed to unions. And it's wonderfully complicated because in China, every worker is in a union. And their relationship to their union and their company is really different than it is in the United States. But It's so fascinating that a huge socialist country has become like the greatest capitalist country in the world.
Stephen and Julia, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. This is fun.
Thanks, John.
Stephen Bogner and Julia Reichardt are the directors of American Factory. It's nominated for the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. You can watch it now on Netflix. Earlier in the Frame Weekend, Michael Stipe talked about using music to address the climate crisis. Up now in L.A. is a performance artist who's tackling the issue from the stage. Miwa Matrayak uses digital animation, live music, and theater to explore how humans are changing the planet and not for the better. Her new stage show is called Infinitely Yours. The Frame contributor Marcos Najara visited with the artist.
This actually isn't recyclable, so...
In the back of her K-Town apartment building, Miwa Matrayak rifles through a blue recycling bin.
Can you imagine how many boxes they must have ordered if it has this much broken up bubble wrap and air pillows? Yeah, I'm glad that we're finding this right now so I could pull it out.
So it's like, it's a dual purpose. It's an interview and a recycling intervention.
Yeah.
It's dark out, so she's wearing a light strapped to her forehead. Is that a spelunking light, Miwa?
Well, I might as well wear this so I can use both hands, right?
Matrayak is sort of the doyen of recycling here in her hood. She often teaches neighbors the do's and don'ts of reusable materials.
I mean, and again, it's not like I'm an expert at this, but like, I know that, you know, actual cans, and this is good because it's actually clean, this like, you know, like diced tomato can.
In equal measure, Matrayak hopes her new show called Infinitely Yours inspires people to treat Mother Nature better. But she quickly realized it all starts at home first.
I started to do a plastic audit where I would save everything that would go into the blue bin for a month so I could see it all laid out at the end of the month and like look at the choices that I made in the grocery store and kind of go through my mind like what are the different choices I can make, right? Like going to a place as a bulk bin instead of buying grains in the plastic bag. But also kind of struggling with things like with tofu, you know, how do you get tofu that's not in a plastic container?
Some of the items Matrayak retrieved from the blue bin have become props for her new show, like a plastic bottle she uses to cast beautiful shadows and shapes on a movie screen. Matrayak combines this type of live shadow puppetry with computer-generated animation and then incorporates her own body to create stunning collages. A projector in the back of a large screen casts the animations she makes in software programs like Adobe After Effects. But that projector also creates a light source for Matrayak to create a silhouette of herself interacting with the images on screen. A second projector in front of the screen adds extra layers of colorful video.
It creates an illusion of sort of like this in-between space of like the physical and real, but also the fantastical. And I think that kind of leads the audience into a place of illusion and transformation and a little bit of magic. Here, I can turn this on.
Behind the screen, Matrayak shows me how she moves herself and a few chairs to create the complex story.
Then I'm having to move these out of the way really fast. And then I have to be here to block the image and have put this back there. I mean, I think there's sort of a riddle of like, you know, the cinematic storytelling versus the theatrical storytelling or theatrical what I can physically do in like real time instead of animation time. So I think that I'll need to make the transition a little bit longer for the Red Cat because right now I'm kind of barely able to do it.
Oftentimes, she's moving behind the screen on her knees or back. She's even learned to walk in a side stretch bend, kind of like the crescent moon pose in yoga.
I've actually gotten accustomed to holding my body like this so that this part of my shadow is the same size, like proportionally the same size as this part of my head. Because if it's here, then my head would be really small. I mean, this is like a small detail, but I think it's the kind of things that I realized through doing this for over a decade.
Matrayak grew up in Japan before moving to California at age 11. She studied physics at UC Santa Barbara before turning to animation at CalArts for grad school. But she's never let go of her love for science, even though she had to let go of its formal study.
Once it got to a level of physics where I didn't get to imagine anymore. It just became like very dry and like math heavy. And it wasn't about like kind of like my big imagination. I think that was kind of led me to going towards art And again, I feel like I've gotten to a place where I can go back to that and, you know, imagine micro and macro worlds through performance and animation and visual storytelling. It should be a struggle in the process to think about how we are impacting the world. Can I be an educator about this? I'm not sure because I don't come with like a background in, you know, climate change science, but I think there is something to be said about the process and struggle of each person. I think it is important to struggle with our choices and not have those things become invisible.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Miwa Metrayek performs Infinitely Yours at Red Cat inside Disney Hall tonight. She'll also perform the piece at the Sundance Film Festival later this month. Speaking of that little festival in Park City, Utah, The Frame team will be headed there next week and will be filing stories for The Daily Show. Next weekend are the Grammy Awards, and we've got a special for you. It features Lizzo, Roseanne Cash, David Crosby, and many others. So make sure you're subscribed to The Frame podcast so you don't miss it. And that's going to do it for today. The Frame Weekend is edited and produced by Darby Maloney, along with Frame producers Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Itzy Quintanilla. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. She's been a tremendous asset over the past year. We are going to miss her as she goes on to do great things. The Frame's theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great holiday weekend. We'll see you back here on Tuesday.